When Anders Breivik went on out to an island conference centre earlier this year and opened fire on a gathering of young left-of-centre budding politicians, the world was stunned. Norwegians in particular were stunned. How could our egalitarian, peace-loving society have nurtured a monster such as this? Asked one newspaper after the massacre. Good question. Are there any answers? And where does this tragedy fit within the rising phenomenon of ultra-right-wing ideology in Europe? Simon Reid-Henry from the University of London and the Peace Research Institute in Oslo has been exploring this phenomenon, both in the context of the Norwegian experience and more broadly in Europe. And I spoke to him a couple of days ago. How do you characterise the Norwegian reaction to what Breivik actually did?
First of all, very different to everything that happened in other parts of Europe when terror attacks took place there, obviously Madrid in 2004 and in London, and of course in America 2001, 10 years ago. It wasn't a response that was rooted in fear. It wasn't a response that was rooted in a need to show that there would be a physical response, an evening of the deck. The response here was much more quiet, more modest, and centered upon, I think, really demonstrating the values that were under attack rather than sort of puffing up feathers and trying to claim them back.
What does that tell you something in particular about Norwegian views of outrage and the way to contain it?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think you see this, or certainly you saw this in the speeches made by the Prime Minister, Jens Stoltenberg, both in his initial press conferences on the night, on Friday the 22nd, as the news of the attacks was unfolding. I mean, here we received a steady stream of updates. Very little was known except that things seemed to be getting worse. And he was really very good at making clear that very little was known. And this was in distinction to other world leaders, David Cameron, President Obama among them, who immediately jumped in to stand beside Norway in its fight against global terrorism, with, of course, the fact was it would prove not to be global terrorism. So the outrage here was not expressed as outrage. It was a case really of defending what Norwegians believe they stand for. The truthful answer is that outrage really just didn't even enter into the picture at all.
Which is very interesting, isn't it? What would the reaction have been if Breivik had been a Muslim, do you think? I mean, that question has been asked a lot there, I gather.
Yeah, it has, and again, I think that, you know, there's an honest answer and a sort of desired answer. I think the truth is, had it been a Muslim, things would have been different. The response would ultimately have played out differently. There would have been calls to up the rhetoric on the anti-immigration debate, which there's a healthy debate about here anyway. The reality is that didn't happen.
People have, and you have yourself, contrasted this particular response with the American reaction to 9/11, which is, of course, is being replayed all around the world. I mean, is it a valid comparison? Here we have a single person who is quite clearly not the full quid and deciding to take action himself, as against a orchestrated campaign to kill people for other purposes. But, I mean, can you compare the two, the response?
It's difficult. I mean, there are features that are the same. I think it's dangerous to use the most obvious bridging word, which would be terrorist. You know, the Americans reached for the word terrorist immediately, and a lot of people also reached for the word terrorist when describing Breivik. But in some ways, that puts the wrong spin on what it was he was trying to do. He saw himself really, I think, as a right-wing revolutionary. This was a man who felt he was defending the European homeland and defending it against a very specific threat, which is the Islamification of Europe that he picked up on in, you know, a very wide literature that's available online, that's discussed in blogs, and that's talked about increasingly in more and more mainstream parties. So he saw himself as defending this sort of somehow purified European legacy. And so while the tactics may be the same, and killing people in the name of a political cause is terrorism in the dictionary, I think it does an injustice to compare the two things. They're really quite different situations.
Yeah. Prime Minister Stoltenberg said what we need is more democracy, more openness, more humanity, but never naivety. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think what he meant there was the opposite of what Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was the leader of the former Front National in France, the right-wing party there that's done increasingly well in the polls. You know, Le Pen jumped in on this debate just a few days after the attacks to suggest that Norway was attacked purely because it had left itself open to attack. It was vulnerable because the politics of the ruling party being pro-immigration, because of the very low level of security control that we have in this country, all these things made it vulnerable. The very debate, the openness with which political issues are debated here, somehow provided an opening for extremists to take hold and take their politics down to the gunsmith. And I think Stoltenberg's comment was the exact opposite of this. You know, his point, and I think it's one that I would agree with, was really that, you know, openness and freedom and more democracy and more humanity, as he put it, doesn't leave you vulnerable. It doesn't leave you more vulnerable than do huge security measures, checkpoints, the need to register yourself with ID cards. These things can't secure you against the insecurable. And terrorist attacks can and will happen wherever. And the opportunity cost of the sorts of measures that someone like Le Pen would have introduced are actually the sorts of things that quite possibly leave you more vulnerable in the long term. And as we're sitting here 10 years on from 2001, 9/11, the attacks in America, and we see the radicalizing effect of the very over-the-top security response that we've seen there, that I think you get a sense of just how the sort of approach advocated that is more security, that is greater protection, can actually achieve the opposite. And I think this is what Stoltenberg was getting at, that really you can't defend against the indefensible, and the best thing you can do is try to promote the values that you want rather than shut down the ones that you happen to disagree with.
What has Breivik done for the future of far-right parties in a broader political context, not just in Scandinavia, but in Europe generally?
His act of terror has come in at a very interesting point. He himself thought that he was going to be the spark to light a flame. You know, he wanted this action to encourage others to take up arms. That's clearly not happened so far, and one hopes that it won't happen, though of course one never knows. But I think regardless of what he hoped to achieve, I think the bigger story here is that, you know, in Europe we have been looking at the rise of the right, of the extreme right, over a number of years now, and Breivik is really more a symptom of this, I think, than a cause. And, you know, by the rise of the right, really, I mean a number of different things. I mean, first of all, there's the most obvious thing, the rise of the extreme right, the acts of the people like the Breiviks of the world, the neo-Nazis, the, you know, the blood and soil nationalists. And then a second group is this sort of legal but still far right, which would include the Sweden Democrats, who became members of parliament in Sweden last year. It would include the rising success of the National Front we were speaking about a moment ago in France under Le Pen's daughter. And it would include the success of the Dutch politician Geert Wilders. And all of these things are on the increase, and they are based upon the same sort of anti-multiculturalist, Eurosceptic dogma that Breivik brought into. But the problem is there's a third group that lies behind this, and this is the mainstream political parties, the likes of David Cameron in the UK, who flirted with the populist radical right in Poland and the Law and Justice Party there, or it includes Sarkozy's expulsion of the Roma. You know, and all of these really are, rather than thinking about it as a rise of the far right, really they're indicating a shift to the far right, because we're having a knock-on effect. We're having the extreme rightists pulling the moderate rightists, pulling the mainstream conservative parties all to the right. And I think this is the landscape, if you like, that Breivik's action takes place within. And I think it raises some very, you know, very important and very difficult questions.
If that far right approach on anti-immigrationism begins to take root more, are we likely to see that infect mainstream politics almost as a matter of course in the immediate future?
I would hope not. I mean, I think that the immediate response in Norway to Breivik's actions has been a shift to the left. The opinion polls prior to the election here have suggested that the Arbeiderpartei, the Labour Party, have done the party of government have seen a boost, and that's been largely at the expense of the right wing party. And the issue of immigration has been dealt with certainly a lot more carefully in the last few days during this election campaign period. So I don't think that actually, certainly based on the experience of Norway, the actions of someone like Breivik does do this. But I think the problem is that the actions of someone like Breivik in relation to the wider right-wing blogosphere, organizations and groups which meet around Europe, can have an effect, because that's what pulls these other parties further to the right.
Is the social media providing those parties with opportunities that they haven't had before?
It might be providing them with new ways of communicating to one another. I think it's very easy, rather, to suggest that technology comes in and changes the entire game. Technology can be used for whatever purpose you wish to put it to. But I do think that one of the things that's been happening, certainly while attention has been focused on other forms of terrorism and extremism, notably those taking place in other parts of the world, is that online media have been a sort of a darker space where there's been less attention, and where right-wing groups have been able to convene, to meet, to share ideas, to sharpen their arguments, even if only to one another. And, if you go through Breivik's various contributions to these things, as I've done, you see him sort of picking up his ideas and gaining confidence from others as he goes along. He took some ideas from the English Defence League. He took other ideas from Norwegian and German writers. So it certainly was an area, a place in which he was able to put his ideas together and to convince himself that he was right. And for him, that was clearly an important thing. It's what enabled him to, take that final step.
If you stand back a bit and look at this in its broader context, and a lot of people are asking the question, the impact of globalization means the breaking down of national borders to the extent that they virtually don't exist anymore, the loss of identity, and there's been libraries written about the whole question of jihad versus McWorld kind of scenarios, the loss of identity and core identity. When you look at Scandinavia, there is a core identity. There is in Britain, there is in France and elsewhere. That loss of identity is the driving force, it seems to me, behind almost all of those political movements. The fear that somehow we are going to be overwhelmed and lose our core identity. And it's something that exists right around the world. Are we going to see more of this? And what is the political manifestation of it likely to be?
I think the first part of the answer is that this is the argument that they present themselves. The anti-multiculturalism of Breivik, which really can be taken as a stand-in for much of these ideologies that you're describing, Chris, that is itself a way of providing a narrative to which people can be drawn in. And it's providing a narrative at a time when a lot of people, under conditions of economic crisis, at a time when they see the left fracturing into a whole series of different, also identity-based politics, and not ones that necessarily correspond to their interests, find very appealing. It tells a useful narrative about a group of a coherent identity, and it gives a sense of urgency. Mm. That identity is under threat. But the reality is that the reasons it's under threat are not the reasons that the right or the extreme right would have you believe. It's under threat because of things like economic crisis, which is being felt much, much, much harder by the working class. And these are the constituents that the extreme right wants to appeal to. At the same time, there's a lot of talk about Islamophobia, but of course, we were mentioning earlier on the Roma and Sarkozy's expulsion of them. Any number of other community groups can be used to scapegoat.
Yeah.
And it's scapegoating that provides you with the binding factor that you need to bring people around what otherwise often appeals under closer scrutiny as a relatively hollow ideology. So I think we need to be careful when we talk about the difference between, or we need to be aware of that there is a difference between the ideas put forward by some of these groups and the reality of the things that are actually driving the trend that they're riding.
Yeah.
They're not the same thing.
So the openness, the ease of movement around and within Europe is, on the basis of what you say, not necessarily under threat. In other words, we're not likely to see more border controls, walls going up.
We've seen border controls, as you say, recently, but there are a variety of other factors which have led to that, and of course, events that have been happening in North Africa are one of those.
Yeah.
Of course, putting up border controls is a sop to the right, but these are political times, as we were talking about earlier, when there is a movement towards the right, even in the sort of mainstream area of politics. So that, you know, it makes sense under those terms. So, you know, but the real answer is that this could happen unless decent arguments for the alternatives are put forward. You know, and this is where the centre and the left and the social democratic have to stand up and take the argument to the right-wing extremists. Because really, I think that's the only way that you can respond.
Will we see elections fought on that question? Is that likely to happen in the immediate future?
That's an interesting question. I mean, there's been a case in Holland recently where Geert Wilders was acquitted.
That's right.
For, you know, race hate speech. And that was taken as a victory by his party. But you could see it as a victory for the sorts of values that the society itself has long stood for. It's hard to see that in the short term. It feels like a defeat. But really, if you're going to, I think, respond to these sorts of events, the only way to do it is through debate and through coming up with the best arguments. You know, that's really what democracies are supposed to be about, and that really was what the response in Norway was all about.